Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. In today's podcast, we release, for the first time since its recording, a presentation by intellectual giant Thomas Sowell from a conference that took place at the Fairmont Hotel in San Francisco back in 1980. Sowell is the subject of our newest public television documentary, Thomas Sowell, Common Sense in a Senseless World, now available on our website and streaming for purchase. For more information and to watch, visit freetochoosenetwork.org. We hope you enjoy today's podcast, and don't forget to subscribe to get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
This is really an historic opportunity. The economic and social advancement of blacks in this country is still a great unfinished task. The methods and approaches for dealing with this task have become familiar over the past few years, and they demand reexamination for at least two reasons. First is the effectiveness of these approaches has been ever more seriously questioned in recent years. There's growing factual evidence of counterproductive results from noble intentions. Some of that factual evidence will be presented here tomorrow. In addition, numerous political trends in recent years indicate declining voter and taxpayer support for these approaches to which some of the older and more conventional black spokesmen, in quotes, remain committed. The events of November 4th were only the most dramatic example of this. They were not the only example. In California, we remember Proposition 13. Across the country, the defeat of school bond issues and spending proposals. With the coming elections, the shifting fortunes of partisan politics may change the party labels of those in power, but Camelot seems unlikely to return. And we certainly cannot bet the future of 20 million people on its return. So there is a historic responsibility implied. We cannot simply run around claiming that the sky is falling, popular as that sometimes seems. Because that approach implies that there is one approach which is the only approach. It implies that the partisans of that approach have some monopoly of either wisdom or virtue, which may be a convenient assumption for them, but no reason why the rest of us should take it seriously. What is a more responsible approach? First, we need to recognize that many methods were failing even before they lost public support. We have to accept the challenge of reexamining why these approaches were failing. We need to accept the responsibility of seeking new approaches, devising new policies for the decade ahead. That's why we're here. To explore alternatives, not to create a new orthodoxy with its own messiahs and its own excommunications of those who dare to think for themselves. The people who are invited to be presenters and discussants are people who are seeking alternatives, people who have challenged the conventional wisdom on one or more issues, people who have thought for themselves instead of marching in step and chanting the familiar refrains. The various speakers and discussants have varying philosophies and different areas of expertise. Some are Democrats, some are Republicans, and some, like myself, are neither. We're here to assess where we are, where we are going, and what are our alternatives. We can start with looking at the present situation. We've come through an historic phase of struggle for basic civil rights, a very necessary struggle, but not sufficient. The very success of that struggle has created new priorities and new urgencies. There are economic realities to confront, self-development to achieve in the schools, at work, and in our communities. The sins of others are always fascinating to human beings, but they are not always the best way to self-development or self-advancement. The moral regeneration of white people might be an interesting project, but I am not sure we have quite that much time to spare. Those who have fought on that front are very much like the generals who like to refight the last war instead of preparing for the next struggle. What are some of the pluses and minuses of our present situation? On the plus side, a dramatic economic rise of blacks during the 1960s, but which is slowed, in some cases stopped, in the 1970s. Many social problems are worsening. Continued disintegration of families, rising numbers of broken homes, one-third of all black homes now. A skyrocketing unemployment rate among black youths, five times as high in the late 1970s as in the late 1940s. Runaway crime rates, of which blacks are the chief victims. There are more blacks murdered every year than whites in absolute numbers. There's also a threat of a permanent underclass whose problems seem immune to prosperity, to equal opportunity, or to the advancement experienced by other blacks. We can see on the horizon the rise of racist groups such as the Nazis, the KKK, not only among the benighted ignorant, but in places where you would never expect such groups, where they never had a foothold before. We can at least ask whether or to what extent the policies of our times have contributed to these problems of our time. Looking ahead to the future, one of the things that we need to focus on are facts about results, not rhetoric about intentions. We need to look not at the noble preambles of legislation, but at the incentives created in that legislation. Very often, legislation intended to help the disadvantaged, in fact, pay people to stay disadvantaged, penalize them to the extent that they make an effort to rise from disadvantage. I mentioned that in the 1960s, there was a dramatic increase in black income relative to white, dramatic increase of blacks in high-level occupations, and that much of this has slowed down, in some cases stopped in the 70s. We need to ask whether the policies that were followed in the 70s had anything to do with this. The question is not whether, on the one hand, affirmative action sounds better than equal opportunity, but whether, in fact, the results show further progress or are slowing down. There are some serious economic reasons why that would be so. When we talk about rent control, we need not be satisfied with cliches about affordable housing. We need to ask the factual question, will there be more housing or less under rent control? When we talk about minimum wage laws, we need to ask not whether a decent wage is a good objective, but whether there will be more jobs at higher pay or no jobs and no pay for increasing numbers of people. If we're going to talk about the future, we have to talk responsibly. We have to have a responsible dialogue with those who disagree with us. If you're serious, it means you're not concerned with scoring points. You're concerned with confronting the actual arguments, not straw men. We don't need to talk about trickle-down theories. I know of no one who has set forth a trickle-down theory. I know of many people who set that up as a straw man to avoid confronting the arguments that have been set forth by those who want to depend upon different mechanisms, different processes from the ones that are in fashion. One of the other cliches of our times is the bootstrap theory, the notion that those who don't support the current agenda, the current political agenda, believe that people should lift themselves by their own bootstraps, should be left to their own devices, that the government is doing too much to help them. There is no such theory. I've been around a few conservative economists in my time, and I've listened, and I've never heard it. I haven't seen it anywhere in history, but I see it as a convenient straw man for people who don't want to confront opposite views. We have in our midst tonight Professor Milton Friedman, who has advocated negative income taxes, vouchers, and other kinds of schemes to benefit the poor. One may argue for or against those schemes. One may argue more safely against them when he's not present. But the issue is not that the government gives too much help to the poor. The problem is that the government creates too much harm to the poor. The cost of taking care of the poor is a relatively small cost compared to the cost of bureaucracy. Some years ago, someone figured out how much it would cost the government to lift every man, woman, and child in the United States out of poverty by the simple expedient of giving them money. That amount that they came to was approximately one-third of what is spent on anti-poverty programs. My colleague, Walter Williams, has figured out how much the welfare expenditure in this country comes to per poor family. It is $32,000. Very few poor families get $32,000. One of the other devices that's often used is to argue that those people who are opposed to the welfare state approach are simply middle class. I wish I had a dollar for every time I've been asked, did I come from an affluent background? And is that why I have such an unfeeling heart for the problems of the poor? I have never heard that question asked of Andrew Young, who indeed did come from an affluent background. Some time ago, I met with a well-known TV newsman, and I asked him, why is it that when I look on television and I see what black spokesmen are saying, that I see them saying diametrically the opposite of what I hear in the black community, what I see in Gallup polls and other polls? For example, that blacks in this country support voucher systems 2-to-1. Blacks in this country prefer more strict enforcement of crime laws, are opposed to quota systems in employment or college admission, and have never had a majority in favor of busing. And yet when I look at the TV news, an entirely different world is created before my eyes on that tube. And he said to me, well, we can put Ben Hooks or Jesse Jackson on TV, but we can't put the Gallup poll on TV. One of the consequences of this is that we're having, in addition to the usual conflicts among groups that any multi-ethnic or multiracial society has, we're having artificial polarization. We're having polarization between a handful of black leaders and a handful of white leaders, many saying things which have very little to do with the beliefs of the people in whose name they're speaking. If we're looking at the future and looking responsibly, we can learn much from the experience of others, which does not mean blind imitation. Sometimes it means avoiding the mistakes that others have made. Many of the very policies that I hear being urged as the royal road to salvation for blacks today are policies that were tried and failed repeatedly by the Irish in the 19th century. It's true that the black history is unique, but of course you'd have to make comparisons even to know that. And uniqueness is never a reason to avoid learning at someone else's expense rather than at your own. One of the problems that I see is the problem of the political interventionist state. And I pose it in categorical terms as if there's some non-interventionist state. We're really talking about different degrees. There seems to be a notion that political interventionism that produces earmarked benefits for this group or that necessarily make those groups better off. But when you think of it, no politician gets elected by sacrificing 90% of the voters for the benefit of 10% of the voters. One thing that all politicians can do of whatever party is count votes. They may create the illusion that they are helping 10%. Indeed, the ideal politician creates that illusion 10 times. But since the government is not generating any wealth, government programs mean nothing more or less than robbing Peter to pay Paul. Now, there is no political capital to be made by robbing Peter to pay Paul if you get Peter's vote and lose Paul's vote. The real trick is to rob Peter to pay Paul on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and rob Paul to pay Peter on Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. Fortunately, the government is closed on Sunday. By following this strategy, you can give a little bit to this group, a little bit to that group, and none of them ever ask, is what is given to A taken from B, and what is given from B to B taken from A? Let's look at some of the losses that blacks suffer from the interventionist state. I think the greatest single loss is that the minimum wage laws promoted by labor unions protect their members by pricing black young people out of the market. There's no way to rise up the ladder if you can't get your foot on the ladder in the first place. Environmentalism, to use the word they like to use, I like to call it the recreational land use special interest. For the benefit of a relatively small group of people, we have set aside vast areas of the United States, an amount equal to one-third of this country, which is to say equivalent to all of the United States east of the Mississippi. Clearly, you cannot set aside that much land, take it off the market, without having the price of the other land rise, and having that rise reflected in rents and mortgage costs all across the country. Of course, the government can come to your rescue with projects and subsidies, but of course, these don't begin to add up to what you have lost by this vast giveaway to a handful of affluent people. One of the great coups of the whole environmental movement is to avoid talking about people and trade-offs. You would never dream that there are people who have alternative demands for the same resource by reading the environmental literature. You hear about protecting the environment, protecting fragile areas. It's very touching. You would never dream that what that means is that one group of people will use the power of the government to put those vast resources at their disposal, far below cost, and keep them out of the hands of other people who have other uses for them. The recreational land that's set aside is land from which you do not build homes, from which you do not get energy, from which you do not create jobs. We have a protection of endangered species that's concerned with every weed and reptile. We also need to recognize that human beings are an endangered species, and especially those who are poor. There seems to be a notion that Darwinian evolution may have been a good idea at one time, but we're going to bring it to a screeching halt in our generation. That despite thousands of years in which all sorts of creatures have come into existence and gone out of existence, in which all sorts of ecologies have evolved, totally different from one another, for some reason, the particular creatures that we have seen, even if there's only a handful of us who've ever seen them actually, those creatures that'll be preserved forever at all cost. The particular kind of ecology that happens to exist at this moment must be frozen for all future time. One of the problems in dealing with the politics of poverty and the programs for the disadvantaged in general, and blacks in particular, is that vast empires can be built on these programs. That these programs definitely prevent poverty among bureaucrats, economists, statisticians, and many others. The poor are also very useful as an entering wedge for programs which ultimately benefit other people who are by no stretch of the imagination poor. That the poor, that blacks, are guinea pigs. They are subjects out there for every, quote, innovative, unquote, idea that pops into the head of some academic. That they are there to provide raw material for surveys, schemes of various sorts. Above all, that their freedom of choice is to be denied in order to correspond to the grand designs of people who think they know better. One of the remarkable editorials that I saw a few years ago appeared in the New Republic as an argument against vouchers. And the argument was that if you had vouchers, then those black parents who were most concerned about their children and most knowledgeable would pull their children out of the public schools, leaving behind only those who didn't care, or whose parents didn't care. And presumably the New Republic thought that was a terrible thing to have done, that while every other group in this country has risen layer by layer as different people began to seize opportunities, blacks alone must all be held back until such time as the very last person in line has understood the value of education. I think that what this betrays is a sense, a sort of proprietary conception of blacks, somewhat at variance with the spirit of the 13th Amendment. I think that if, insofar as we're going to enlist the intelligence, the desires, and the commitments of blacks themselves, we have to do so by offering more choice in more areas to let them decide what is best for themselves and not to turn that job over to academics and government officials. Thank you.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.